Meet the CXO. Wir reden, was verbindet.
Hello everyone. I'm Claudia Nemat, Board Member for Technology and Innovation. I'm very delighted to welcome Adrian Daub to our session. He is Professor for Comparative Literature and German Studies at Stanford University in California. In his research, he focuses on the 19th century, in particular, the intersection of literature, music, and philosophy, on German idealism and romanticism, on gender and sexuality, and interestingly, also on the narratives of the tech industry. Adrian Daub was born in Germany and is living and working in the Silicon Valley. Therefore, he is combining a European with an American view in his books and articles. In 2020, he released his book, What Tech Calls Thinking. And I must confess, reading his book, I was incredibly intrigued by what I consider a very brilliant observation of the narratives of the tech industry of the Valley. In his book, Adrian Daub is unmasking some of those narratives, for example, failure culture, the role of disruption, and the glorification of platforms over content. So today we will have a conversation about those narratives, their strengths, their weaknesses, maybe about alternative narratives. And therefore, I'm incredibly delighted to have Adrian Daub here as my guest. Dear Adrian, a very, very warm welcome to our session.
Thank you, Claudia. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Adrian, please allow me to set some context for our audience before we start about Telekom and myself. So Deutsche Telekom is a leading telecommunications company, and we are the only telco in the world which is present both in the United States and in Europe. Now, our aim is to become more, I would call it a digital telco, a software-driven telco, but with the human being in the center. And now for me, it means we should develop things that are good for humans and that don't produce harm. Now, the issue is, I believe what is good or meaningful should not be defined by the tech telco industry alone by ourselves. And therefore, we have invited people from many different areas, other sectors, customers, artists, and thought leaders from academia. And I must confess, as a techie, a European, and a mother of two kids, I'm fascinated by narratives, and especially by unmasking their manipulative intent. So therefore, again, Adrian, it's super to have you here. And if you allow, I would start with a personal question. What has actually inspired you as a professor for comparative literature and German studies to deal with the narratives of the tech industry?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one I've wondered about myself as I started writing this. I thought, gee, am I really the person to write this? So first off, thank you for having me, and thank you for this first question, which, yeah, does cut to the heart of this. What can someone who is at home in the humanities, someone who is, you know, very much still a European transplant on the Western seaboard of the United States, what can I bring to the discussion of this very peculiar place in which I find myself? Maybe give two examples of what made me think about tech and made me think, hey, this is something worth investigating. I hadn't at the time thought about publishing it yet, but I thought I should investigate. One of the things I teach is, as you said, philosophy and critical theory. And so I tend to see as part of my job to educate young people to think critically. And sometime around 2012, I noticed that some of the most brilliant students I had here at Stanford, and I mean, brilliant at Stanford means, you know, world-class brilliant, kind of going into these big tech companies, which was fine. You know, they needed money. They wanted to work in an exciting company. I didn't begrudge them that. But they explained it to me in terms that seemed to replicate the sales pitches of these companies and the narratives that they constructed for themselves in a way that struck me as utterly uncritical. And I thought, gee, either I'm not a very good teacher of critical thinking, or something's the matter here. Yeah. Or maybe the tools that I'm giving them are not actually helping them be analytical where it matters most. And so my gamble at first was to see what very traditional interpretive methods could do with these narratives. And on the other hand, what makes us as a society really abandon those tools, right, of just close reading, paying attention, looking behind the narrative, saying that if an employer, you know, tells you something, it doesn't necessarily have to be the objective truth. You know, what makes us put all those things aside specifically when it comes to the tech industry? I don't think anyone would go to a car company feeling this way, but my students did feel that way working at Google. And then something funny happened. As I started really writing the book and getting serious, the same students came back from, they would visit me. These companies are 20 miles, 10 miles down the road. They'd visit me and they'd say, you know, they'd start with these internal critiques of these places where they'd worked. And they'd often say, I love working at Google. I love working at Facebook. I think this is very fulfilling work. I do think it's important in this and this and this way. I also think there are these problems. I also think that there is these concepts that they've never really thought about. I do not think that failure culture means what they think it means, et cetera, et cetera. And so I realized that I didn't have to write a book. I never wanted to write a book against my students. And I was really lucky and glad that I didn't have to. And so in some way, I wrote it with their voices in mind, with the journey they went on in mind, and thinking about the way, in some way, critical thinking and critical theory can still sort of have purchase on these workplaces, on the products they create, on the platforms that dominate our lives, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those would be the two. One was sort of the thing that set the first spark. And then the other thing gave me the confidence that this was a book worth writing.
It's fascinating. I can absolutely understand the phenomenon that people, even outside tech, take those stories, the narratives, for granted without alternatives. Now, in your book, Adrian, you are describing that behind the philosophy of the Silicon Valley, there are many narratives, some of them old or much older than the Silicon Valley, and then they're being reshaped and put into a new form. Could you explain to our audience what narratives are and what are the most powerful narratives of the valley you discovered?
You're absolutely right. It's a narrative-driven industry in a way that I think few today are. I'm imagining that historically there are others. You know, where the idea is to find out what the future holds, you come to Silicon Valley, right? Which, you know, this is a place where a lot of very interesting stuff happens. But where does this idea come from that here you get front row seats to the future in some way? By now, a lot of these companies make quite a lot of money. For a long time, these narratives even sort of defied conventional economic wisdom, right? People would look at these companies that were hemorrhaging money and say, well, that's the future, right? So that's what I mean when I say it's deeply narrative driven. It's because you can tell yourself a story about how losing money doesn't really mean what it would mean in another context, that, you know, having everyone be mad at each other in your board of directors doesn't mean what it would mean somewhere else. So yes, these intense narratives that govern broader perception of the tech industry, that govern to some extent the way the tech industry thinks of itself, but by now, I think, govern far more the external gaze cast upon Silicon Valley. Now, what is that gaze? Well, one thing people always talk about and like to see here is disruption, right? So the idea that established structures are slightly suspect because they are established, not because there's anything wrong with them particularly, just they're old and they're established, and that, you know, upsetting them or discombobulating them or re-energizing them is automatically a good thing. Right. And now we can see very easily how that's true in some contexts. What's interesting about the narrative that is applied to Silicon Valley is that disruption is taken to be a good in almost any situation. Right. That's one I trace in the book. Another is the idea of failure. And here I have to say, takes its departure from maybe the most appealing aspect of this industry, as far as I can tell, which is the idea that if something doesn't work, that's all right. You try again. At the same time, I think that there is a real, there's strength to that narrative. It is, however, in our globalized world, really telling who gets to fail better, who gets to fail at all, and who gets to come back from failure, right? So that's a narrative that isn't necessarily incorrect. I do think that there is something really lovely about the idea that you can just really mess up and learn a lesson from it. Isn't that wonderful? But the problem is that the idea, it doesn't go for everyone. Even in Silicon Valley, it doesn't go for everyone. If an Uber programmer screws up, yes, they can fail again and again, and you know they will hopefully grow from the experience. If an Uber driver does the same thing, their failure is largely final, right? Usually some pedestrian has been hit or a biker is dead and that's it, right? So these things only go so far. And of course, there are also real differences about who we allow to fail and what technologies we have for managing failure, right? I would say that, you know, Europe specifically has a very old technique for managing failure. It's called the social welfare state. If things didn't work out at one job, well, there is a way to make sure you're taken care of until you find the next one, right? It's very noticeable that that's often that this new narrative of failure essentially is played out against the old ones and basically used to destabilize some of the ways we have found to buffer people against failure. So that's another kind of narrative. A third is, I think, the idea of the genius. And we see that a lot in, I think, in European discourses around Silicon Valley, where, you know, there's this focus, intense focus on these kind of messianic figures, right? Or villain figures too, right? Even though these are gigantic companies where tons of people decide what goes into the product, what doesn't, what direction things take, right? But we sort of tend to think of them as this kind of almost performance art piece by the Mark Zuckerbergs and by the Steve Jobses of the world. And a lot of how we think of how companies work, how value is generated, and how we work together in either companies or in a society is shaped by this idea that there's this lone genius, right, who really shapes what our world looks like, as opposed to there's this big company with many people working in it who may have different opinions about it. And, you know, we might want to engage them in conversations. Like, no, we now have just Mark Zuckerberg, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. Well, with Elon Musk, it might literally be true that it's just one guy. Only he seems to know what he's doing. But in all the other cases, right, these are large professional organizations. And we tend
to... they have the hero cult, right? So why what would you say, why have those narratives, the creative destruction, the disruption, or the failure cult, or the schemes around the lonely genius, why have these narratives become so powerful? You actually mentioned that in other areas or other industries that hadn't been the case, at least not recently, not over the last decades. What made them so powerful and folks outside the tech industry adopt them so easily without questioning?
Yeah, that's the really big question. And I think that there are a couple of answers to that that I sort of arrived at in the book. One, it has to do with the tech industry itself, which, if you recall, well before it made all the money in the world, it spent all the money in the world. In the case of something like Uber, it still is spending a lot of money, a lot more money than it's making. At that point, having a charismatic leader who claims that the rules somehow don't apply to the company is pretty important. Otherwise, your shareholders are going to eventually lose patience with you, right? In the case of Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos, we see that literally the story, the legend of the founder really kept people from asking questions they really should have asked about the technology very, very early on. So there are things native to the tech industry there. There is also the fact that these ideas have deeper roots in Northern California, you know, a kind of individualism, a kind of sense that companies can be a form of creative expression did not start with the tech industry here, or didn't start in the tech industry here, and sort of migrated into tech from the hippies, the counterculture, and that kind of thing. So there are also sort of cultural factors. But of course, as you say correctly, it's not just about the tech industry. If the insurance industry were to tell stories about itself like this, no one would listen. No one would care. We listen, we watch, we care. We make biopics about Mark Zuckerberg and about Elizabeth Holmes and about apparently Travis Kalanick and Adam Neumann, right? There's something very unusual there. And I think that is a question more for the rest of us who are not in Silicon Valley companies. There is something here that focused our attention in ways that other industries didn't and couldn't. And I think, again, there are two answers I think that I can sort of come to, or I came to in my book. One has to do with just the financial crisis of 2008, that there really weren't that many places to look for inspiring stories. Capitalism wanted to tell stories about itself. Well, this was kind of the place you'd go, right? And it was pretty and it was in color and it was a bunch of young white guys and they were kind of a little odd, but not that odd. Their product was cool, but at that point, not that scary yet.
Yes, right? Not that scary, yes.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
And then the second answer, I think, is it just has to do with a kind of lust for disruption that we all have. We like the idea of the upstart. We like the idea of the status quo being shaken up. It's just a better narrative, right? That's why we like telling, you know, the Tesla story in the car industry, right? Like, that's exciting. It's just unexciting when a successful company successfully pivots to being a little bit more successful, right? I'm sure that a reader of the Handelsblatt or of Fortune magazine or Forbes might like that story, but it's not cover material for a lot of other newspapers. There you need an underdog, and Silicon Valley has been really good at presenting itself as a global underdog while being a global monopolist, essentially.
By the way, from the very beginning, from the hippie movement to becoming really superpowers in the world, so to say, from pink to big, right?
Yeah.
If you take that, that's quite interesting, because latest by now, those companies are global superpowers, but to some extent, the narrative of being the underdog, the David against Goliath, still holds true. So what is actually the secret recipe, if you have looked into this, into the capability to still portray yourself as the small underdog, as the victim fighting against the bad rules of the others, which they are trying to impose on you? Where does that secret come from?
Well, I do think that some of it, I mean, I apologize, a very blunt and very simplistic answer, but I think it holds more truth than I would have thought when I started the research, which is just a lot of these people are nerds, as we say in the United States, and nerd culture understands itself as being marginal, being underdogs, being beset by larger bullies, right?
Uh-huh.
It is a narrative that people within that industry are very familiar with from their own personal lives and therefore would be very likely to self-apply. I should say that I think that ability, and I do think it was uncanny for a long time how well they did this, is fraying by now. And I think it's fraying from two ends. I think that there are people within that industry now who are very open and clear about the power they hold and are scared of that power and say, this has to be regulated, this has to be controlled, or at least we have to be in communication with the broader public about this, right? Especially after the 2016 presidential election in the United States, I think a lot of that came to a head in these companies where people said, we can't pretend to be powerless here anymore. We are powerful beyond what we probably should be. And then the second thing is a lot of these companies are starting to just behave like big, bad monopolists, exactly like the kinds of companies that they allegedly set out to challenge. You know, in California, we had a proposition, Proposition 22, that sought to enshrine in state law the idea that Uber drivers are not employees of Uber. California had decided that they very clearly were. And if you look at the ads that the companies, the big rideshare companies, ran around that campaign, around that proposition, it's a direct democratic proposition. So you run a lot of ads. They ran about $200 million worth of ads. And basically the argument was, you know, rides will be becoming more expensive. We might leave California and, you know, it's bad for business, which is not that, right? It's no longer the rhetoric of we're making the world a better place or we're bringing people together or something like that, or we're fighting climate change, was Uber's thing for a second there. No, it is. That's how a tobacco company tells you that they should be able to sell cigarettes, right? It's exactly that way. And so I do think that this uncanny ability that had a spell over us may be coming to an end. I think this was about a 10 to 15 year period or 10 to 20 year period where this was possible. I don't know if this is going to be true 5 years from now.
Yeah. By the way, I completely agree that we are now experiencing a techlash because there's too much of a discrepancy between reality or some of the negative consequences of all of that and the originally very inspiring narratives which had this David against Goliath phenomenon. Nevertheless, interestingly, what I'm observing that many people, also business leaders, outside the tech industry or outside the valley, out of the United States, still sometimes try to copy, to imitate some of those patterns which are based on those narratives. What's your view on that one, on this copying of the success?
Well, that's
patterns?
The interesting thing, right? I do think that these narratives might be losing their power in the place that kind of gave birth to them.
They travel.
But the problem is they have a life outside of the valley, right? They're really gone global. And what I find troubling is exactly that. I think some of the deleterious political consequences of this might well be with us for a lot longer, not because the tech companies still peddle these stories, or they might try, but they might not really succeed. No, but because everyone else has adopted them. That's sort of my fear by now. I ended up in the book not being particularly mad at the tech industry. You know, they have a product, they want to make money. I mean, I have trouble having a problem with that. It's the fact that people who ought to know better sort of adopting these. And I am very troubled by that. I think you're right, that it's getting copied everywhere and it's being moved into areas where it really has no place, right? The idea that you could shake up the video store business, you know, really, you know, feel bad for video store clerks, but, you know, I fully understand why that happened. Once you get to disrupting, I don't know, medical care, it's getting a little scary, right? I mean, there's a reason why all these companies did that with apps and, you know, fun little icons, and they didn't do, you know, can you find an ambulance or a blood transfusion or something like that? And why the federal regulatory apparatus in the United States that has been pretty hands-off with these companies overall, unless they threaten, you know, Donald Trump, why it came down on Theranos like a ton of bricks. Because once you start telling people they have diabetes, when they don't in fact have diabetes, some kind of Rubicon has been crossed.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's indeed true. Maybe looking at Europe, somehow Europe seems to be squeezed between the gigantic success of the US-based tech companies on the one hand, and then the also commercial success of tech made in China, which of course comes out of a completely different value system. And now you see those two superpowers clashing, and we are actually observing a tech war in our industries where the geopolitical conflicts unfold themselves in the field of tech. Now in Europe, now everybody is trying to figure out what digital sovereignty could mean. And I interpret this also a little bit, not only about the look for successful tech companies, but also the question, what could be alternative strong narratives which fit better to the ideas of democratic and humanistic values? By the way, from my point of view, a totally unanswered question. Do you have any, coming out of Europe, any reflections on what could be alternative strong narratives for the Europeans in this big debate?
Yeah, I do think that one thing that Europe brings to the table, and that became very clear to me talking to a lot of people here for my book, is just the kind of granularity, right? A lot of Europeans, I think, are worried about not being able to muster the kind of financial resources that are behind mm-hmm. these companies, right?
Yes.
The gigantic investment firms, the venture capital firms, the large pension funds here that invest, that sort of thing. I think that's both a blessing and a curse, right? That money says that every company that wants that kind of money needs to eventually attain a dominance and valuation that is frankly incompatible with serious regulatory and ethical standards, right? A lot of these companies will stop making money if and when regulatory standards tighten, or if there's sufficient pushback from civil society, and I think there could be. I don't think these things are inevitable. But of course, Silicon Valley has very different companies too. It's just that you don't read about them on cover pages very often, right? Companies that want to make good tech that interacts profitably with government, other institutions, civil society, the media, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they often look to Europe, right? Because Europe has a more muscular regulatory state, right? Often a dual one between the EU and the national context, right? National governments. And they often sort of try to learn from Europe, how do you not disrupt? How do you fit in? How do you make sure you triangulate with these other stakeholders? How do you make sure that you don't create this product that's a runaway success, but ultimately destroys democracy accidentally, or that, you know, so it turns out exposes dissidents to, you know, death and incarceration halfway around the world, right? Or incites a genocide or something like that, right? I do think that they often look to the EU, especially, to sort of think like, well, what are the minimum standards we have to meet here? So I think that is the space for Europe. How to give tech freedom, right? Unlike a lot of the big companies in China, but how to, you know, give it a kind of very European sense of freedom, where freedom comes with responsibility, where freedom is about actualizing your ideas within a context. I'm not saying the context doesn't matter. The context is BS. The context is just bullying. I will bulldoze any context. I will substitute my own genius for, you know, these grown and frankly traditioned structures. I think that Europe is a perfect place to figure that out.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned granularity and stakeholders. And my belief is that in Europe, beyond regulation, etc., there is a better chance to move more quickly towards a more stakeholder-centric version of capitalism. Yeah, so our credo, or my credo, is always, I call this, we need to turn all stakeholders into friends. And of course, the stakeholders are customers, but they're also our own employees. By the way, all employees, not two or three classes of employees, to your point. No? Yeah, so also the ones who do the digging, yeah, and not just the ones who do the coding. Then the business partners, shareholders, of course, as well, but also the society in which we are active, yeah, which deals with the commitment to move towards carbon neutrality, for example. So which is a more complex version of capitalism, stakeholder-centric, instead of just being shareholder-centric. Now, interestingly, also US-based pension funds and capitalists are moving into the direction and asking exactly those questions, no, about ecological and social and governance criteria, etc. Now, my question to you, as someone who has been dealing so much with these narratives, of course, granularity or stakeholder centricity is more complex. Yeah, so to say, it's more complex to have a balanced view on the different stakeholder interests. In a short-term horizon, there can be even contradictory views, whereas in long-term, it moves in the same direction. Now, I'm sometimes wondering if you embrace something which is more complex, more complicated. Is it possible to find also good stories or narratives for that? Because it seems to me that the oversimplification was part of the fundamental power of those narratives, good or bad, the evil, the god. Yeah, so that's easier, no? The hero, the creative disruption, the David against Goliath, than to say, oh, we actually need to be reflective about the world in which we are in, and we need to look at the interests of the various groups. So what does that mean in terms of, yeah, storytelling and narratives?
This is, I think, a really important and a deeply European question, right? It's also true for the EU, that it's, it has a hard time telling stories about itself. And I think on the one hand, yes, it is harder to tell those kinds of stories. They're not just granular, they're also going to be smaller, right? A lot of tech companies, at least in the early days, really didn't have any part of their business that was considering the kind of broader social ramifications. And if so, they were kind of off to the side. The center of the business was always very clearly the coding, the programming, right? The platform. You know, the very fact that a company reflects on its place in the broader society will render the narratives, very granular. And then the question is, how consumable are they? How exciting a story
can
you really tell?
It, yeah. Yeah.
And I think one answer is, maybe the best answer is just to be distrustful of stories. If it sounds like too good a story, don't believe it. I do, and I think that's hard, but I do think that part of my book, I think, is about the need to just stop making myths. Myths can be okay, they can be helpful, they can guide us through reality in a kind of gentler way. But I do think at some point we just maybe have a duty to look behind the story and, you know, and to not to mistake a sales pitch for a kind of founding myth for something, right? So I don't know, I'm torn about it. I would love to be able to tell more granular stories. I find that when I offer them to European newspapers, no one wants to print them because, you know, they're contradictory. There are things that went well. There are things that didn't. You know, some people are happy with the way the company turned out, others less so. You know,
simplification has a very strong appeal to
absolutely.
People. It's easier to write about it. It's easier to attract people. And by the way, that reminds me of another question I wanted to ask you, and that's about purpose. You know, there's an increasing assumption by business leaders and people who are recruiting people, especially in the younger generation, that it's very important to have purpose. Because it's not only the money why people are coming, but also the purpose. Now, here again, the purpose could be an oversimplified myth and then people are running after it, or it could be an authentic person. So what is the, I would call it recipe or the avenue to create a truly authentic person rather than good washing everything? Yeah. So even I was thinking when I said our motto to offer meaningful technology, but I do not want to good wash or greenwash. Yeah. So I want an honest debate about, because not everything is good. Of course not. What we are not doing, not either. So do you see a chance in having like a real authentic debate about purpose and what you are doing without doing this, it's too good to be true, good washing type of purpose thing?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the best analogy I could think of, you know, this is maybe something that in companies you don't see as often, but people who join institutions, right? Mm-hmm. I work at a university where I think my purpose of teaching young, very smart people, I wake up very happy with that job every day. Do I therefore think that everything my institution does is good? No. I also think it's, you know, it is a gigantic landholder sitting on stolen land. It is a gigantic investment company investing in some terrible things, all these things. And I will hold my employer accountable for that. I will spend later today sometimes yelling at Stanford's provost. So, you know, I think that that kind of relationship is probably the best we can ask for. Corporations are, like universities, gigantic institutions, and institutions are going to have moments of identification for us, and they're going to offer places where we can identify with the purpose, with the mission, and they're going to offer moments of real conflict and dissonance. And, you know, I think that living with and in both is really, really important. So I think that in some ways, you know, we have scripts for doing this. I do think the one other part of it in terms of purpose that I tend to think about, which is not so much about the greenwashing worry or about its relationship to climate change, is a relationship to labor. A lot of these myths in Silicon Valley probably didn't start primarily to pull in investors. Well, they may have done that too, but they also were meant to pull labor out of very young people. They were remunerated well. They were paid well. They were not paid nearly commensurate with the amount of work they put in, right? And the reason they were told to do that was because of the mission, because of the purpose, right? We're not a company, we're a family, right? And I do think, you know, one of the duties, even in ethical governance, whether it's a university or in a corporation, is, you know, in German, we have the saying, die Kirche im Dorf lassen, leave the church in the village, right? It is in the end a workplace. It is in the end a company, right? That means mess. That means some exploitation. It means you're going to be asked to do more than you should, right? It means that you should look at your contract and make sure you're being paid for the labor that you render. And so I think to some extent, you know, keeping things non-mythical, right, actually gives us clarity of the purpose, right? Why are we saying we're doing this? What are we doing to accomplish that? Are we getting there? Right? These are all questions that become a lot more answerable when we're not sort of asking for a big myth, but we start asking kind of the small bore narratives, right?
Yeah.
Confront our workplace as an institution.
So it's about the attitude with all great identification and Werkstolz. We are always looking for always to have human beings who keep a healthy, skeptical attitude towards any practices. And by the way, that obligation to dissent, I personally believe, is anyhow good, because it prevents you as a business from moving on a wrong path. Because I believe in the long run, there will be anyhow a lash against you if you don't behave properly and for the benefits of society, sooner or later, it will hit you. So as we are coming to the end, Adrian, is there any question or ask you would have for me?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, I mean, I'm fascinated by getting these questions from someone who works at a company that feels very legacy and is very different, is as different from a Silicon Valley startup as one could be, if that's okay to say. And I would ask you, what is the narrative that you bring forward to navigate this very strange transition? And what are the things within a structure like the telecom that you want to maintain as you open yourself towards the future? What are sort of the things that you think, when you look at Silicon Valley, you think, I'm so glad we don't do that or we don't have that?
No, actually, I must say it's quite interesting because Deutsche Telekom today compared to like it was 10 or 20 years ago is incredibly different. So not to be compared to the old legacy company. So we have in our DNA quite a bit which is really tech, almost like a software companies, and others where we continue to dig into the ground and put fiber into the ground. Yeah, so we have a big construction business. But on the narrative, so for Deutsche Telekom, it's very much around the idea that our business purpose is to connect people to enable human understanding. And therefore, the idea is really beyond providing, of course, the best connectivity experience or products that are easy to use, to make sure that those are solutions which help to solve problems. Of course, always taking in account that we are a connection, a connectivity providing company. But we have seen here in the pandemia, for example, that is pretty critical to have things that work end to end perfectly for people to be connected. And I believe it's in the end very much about the attitude of human beings. And I give you an example. When we had these terrible floods in Germany last summer, and we had a situation where people were coming from all over Germany and other countries to help. And then it took just a day to re-erect 70% of the antennas, and we even helped all the public emergency people to get going. So, and that sense of duty, even if that might sound a little bit old-fashioned, the sense of duty of connecting people and really making sure that things work, I think is a powerful narrative. And the way I see it going forward, I'm saying we need to digitize and become a software-driven company, but not as a purpose in itself or as a religion, but the commitment to do it in a way. And you know, I'm a physicist and my husband is a medical surgeon and an entrepreneur. And in the medical doctors have something which is the Hippocratic Oath. And that means two things. Number one, it means that you need to be able to master your engineering discipline. You need to be able to do things well. Whatever you do, whether you are a university professor, an engineer, or a physicist. But it also means that you do not a surgery because you can make a lot of money with that and the patient doesn't need it. And that is the path of the Hippocratic Oath. And what I'm trying to establish here is the attitude that we need to develop human-centered software and technology. Now, do I want to create a myth out of it because I'm claiming, oh, all is perfect? No. I describe it more as a permanent, you know, aim, as an aspiration, which we should try to work on. Yeah, and I'm experiencing that a lot of people find that appealing, and therefore we are also hiring talent from the tech companies. Yeah, so in that transformation. So that's maybe what drives me. I spent a lot, many years in the Silicon Valley, but the reason why I came back to Europe was to hopefully do something which moves into this direction.
I mean, that sounds really, really interesting. And I think that we haven't talked about the concept of duty there. I think that that's, you know, if we had more time, I think that I would want to go more in that direction. It's one of those old-fashioned ideas that well might tell different stories here, right? And that is very much absent from a lot of the discourses around Silicon Valley. That, you know, I just did my job because that's my job. Is you know, that's how I feel about it, about my job. But I don't think that's how a lot of tech tends to see both its product and its labor force.
Yes. And by the way, I think in this sense of duty, it has the component, of course, it must provide the best customer experience. And the benchmark is what tech provides. So it has to be easy to use, you know, it has to have a great customer experience, but that is only one element of it. There's a second element in it, which is it must not provide harm. And even in difficult times, I feel committed to make sure that it works. It has two components. Right. Yeah. And I think if we manage to get that done, I would even consider this a more powerful narrative then the idea there is tech only and the human beings have to see how they get along with that. At least that's my European and techie conviction on it, yeah, I have to say.
I think that sounds exactly right.
So I hope we will move quickly into this direction. In any case, Arjan, it was very exciting to talk to you and to have you as my guest today here. So
really,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.